Hello, welcome to episode 91 of the Payers and Players podcast. We got a special guest with us today. Before we get into that, if you would, follow us on Twitter at Payers Players. We really appreciate it. So, Scott, you want to dive into our guest and introduce him?
Yeah, I think you're selling him short by saying we had a special guest. We got a legendary guest today. He's a player. He was a two-time All-American at Georgia and at his alma mater. He's been the coach there for 36 seasons. He's won 4 national titles and 29 SEC championships. Coach Manny Diaz, welcome to the podcast.
Good to be with you, Scott and Robert.
Well, hey, just real quick before we get started, a couple years ago, my son was playing Winter Southerns, and he played a kid from Athens, Georgia. And after the match, I said to him, you know that you just played the Georgia coach's son, and he was watching you. And he was like, oh, Manny Diaz was watching me? I was like, no. Kirby Smart was watching you. So he was disappointed. So he was disappointed that it was Kirby. He wanted you to watch his match. So thought that was a good story.
That's funny.
There's probably not many athletes that Kirby would watch them and then them be disappointed. So that's the funny story, Scott.
Yeah.
Hey, Coach, would you start real quick? Just give us a quick tour of your office and the view you've got outside the window there.
Yeah. No. So yeah, I can see all our courts from my desk. Try to keep that sun from shining in the morning. Comes in from that side, but yeah, no, just got our national championship teams, some of them on this little wall, and a national championship poster. I think that's 2008. Yeah, just some of the personal stuff. I got all kinds of, family stuff, I guess, reminders. And we got some two of our players that I have coached that made top 10 in the world. Michael Pernfors and John Isner, as well as Matthias Boker, who won the Triple Crown. Some, I guess, personal recognitions, Coach of the Year awards, et cetera. But now, over here, just right by our tennis courts, feel fortunate to come into this facility every day. I have to pinch myself. It's just a great sight.
Yeah, it's not a bad view, not a bad place to come into the office. My office has just a window in the door to see into the hallway. So you got me doing that a mile.
Yeah, it's a cool looking office. Cool office, cool view. So Thank you, Scott. You want to start with the first question?
Sure. So I mean, one of the amazing things about being at a facility, an institution like Georgia for 36 years, you've probably had a lot of amazing players come through there. But maybe one of the most amazing players was a player you had in probably your first season, and Al Parker. And I was wondering if you could tell us a little bit about Al and what kind of player he was, because people that know his story, he's one of the most decorated junior players of all time, had some injuries that wasn't able to make it on the pro tour, but just an amazing player, amazing person. Give us some memories of Al Parker as a player and a Georgia Bulldog.
Well, it was. Al was the highest decorated. He's got more gold balls, junior gold balls than anybody in the history of the USTA. So, he's been somebody that I've known since he was like I think 12 or 14 years old. The first time I kind of saw him play as a junior, because his family is from close to Savannah, Claxton, Georgia, and he didn't have anybody to practice with over there after he got pretty good. So he would have to travel about an hour to get some tennis lessons and some practice in Savannah. His family is they're owners of the world famous fruitcake. That's Claxton Fruitcake Company. And Mid Parker, his dad, is just an outstanding gentlemen. He would always bring us for Christmas a big box of fruitcakes that we kind of gave out throughout the athletic department. But coaching Al was one of the easiest jobs anybody could have had. Just a gentleman, just a well-behaved. I should say this with caution. He was a perfectionist. He was so conscientious, I should say. He would come every day prepared for practice. He went through high school and college with a 4.0. So he was very, very focused and very determined to be the best that he could be. As a professional, he probably didn't enjoy the road as much as wanted to and envisioned as a professional. His senior year of college developed a condition that had been with him for a long time, but it really just became a little bit more of an issue. He had a lower back condition that really would become inflamed and really give him a lot of discomfort and a lot of pain. So he, as a pro, he was not able to be the player that we all wanted him to be, right? That he worked so hard to be, and after one or two years, he decided, he would come back and to the United States, and he decided to go to Harvard and get his MBA. And he's ultra successful now. And he's a close friend and a dog for life.
Yeah.
Yeah, he's featured in a movie called 50,000 Balls. Have you ever seen it?
I have not.
Yeah, it's a tennis, kind of a junior tennis documentary. I recommend, we always recommend it to anybody that's on. And okay. TJ Puro, who played at Duke, his dad made it. And so you could see it on like Apple TV Plus, on Apple TV. But they really kind of tell his story, and he tells his story as well in it. It's really good. So I'm so happy Scott asked that question, because I totally forgot he played for y'all. I mean, what a tradition. Can you talk a little bit about some of the best players that you've coached, and some of them, maybe the ones that people don't even know of?
Well, it's been a long time. This is my 42nd year this year. I did 6 years as an assistant and an associate head coach under Coach McGill, who I played for. So, it was a different era in so many ways. I mean, from our travel budgets to our facility, that has come such a long way to basically, back then there were just a handful of programs that really competed for national championships. Now it's such a different story. You have so many good teams. Used to be that if you were outside of the top 10 or 15 nationally ranked teams, I didn't lose much sleep. Now you play somebody that's ranked 45 and you still got to worry. Anybody can beat anybody. There's so much parity and so many good teams, so many good coaches. So the game has changed a lot. But for us, I mean, we've had so many great players, from Matthias Boker, who is one of only three players to win the Triple Crown. He also decided after a couple of years to go to Harvard and get his MBA, and now he works for Apple, very successful, and and still very close to our program. But from guys like Hisham Hameda, who now lives in Abu Dhabi and an executive for M&M Mars, I believe it is, worldwide, to you probably have to ask me about more guys than I can recall at the top of my head. Coaching Michael Pernforce was a special deal for me. Somebody that just found ways to win, just incredible ways. When you thought that he was out of a match, he'd always bring out his best. I don't know that there's anybody else that has won more matches for Georgia, and he only played 2 years.
Right.
After winning the junior college national championships 2 years in a row, he came to Georgia as a junior and just won so much for us. There's a gazillion players that have come through our program that have late and left their mark. And some of them, we take a great deal of pride in the success that we have at the bottom of the lineup. Our courts are a little bit tiered. So the bottom three courts are sort of a little bit more in a bowl, and we take such great pride in calling that the pit. And we call that the pit because that's where national championships are won for us.
Right.
The value of, a good number four and a good number six player to us is paramount. And, we've had so many good players that have played down there and just been just so important to our success. John Roddick started as a number two junior in the country. He came over here and played number five for us his freshman year. and, you know, moved up and played one and two for us after that. But so many of our players start down there. And that's, you know, that's where our history is really marked.
Yeah, it's amazing. Robert also works for Apple, so he's going to have to look at Matthias Booker later on and connect with him. So maybe they're they can find something to collab on.
Yeah, that'd be good. Well, tell us a little bit about Scott wants to know a little bit about also coaching John Isner.
Yeah, I mean, the reason I ask is he's such a unique player. Probably you don't have many 6'10 guys. And, you know, probably that was a project. I'm not sure how he was as a freshman coming in. But, you know, what was some of the things that when he first came in, how did you say, we're going to develop your game and we're going to see you succeed at the ATP level?
I think, you know, with John, it was such a different case because he was so tall and so lanky. I mean, he was 6'9" at the time. And he was 195 pounds. So physically, he was from where he eventually got to by his senior year. I think he probably grew another inch and a half or two in his four years here. He, you know, he put on 45 pounds of muscle. He went from being one of our least flexible players to our most flexible player. So he worked very hard on his strength, but he also worked very hard on his flexibility because as a freshman, he was mostly playing at number three, some at number two. And by the end of the year, his body wasn't strong enough to really, you know, keep him healthy. So he developed some lower back problems by his freshman year. And he was very limited in our postseason. So he took the summer to get healthier and made a commitment to get stronger and work on his flexibility, like I said. And, you know, even that sophomore year where he really made a jump and really became our one or two player, you know, I actually was very careful to bring him along slowly. You know, I even had some fights, good natured fights with his older brother because he kept saying that he was our number one player. And I didn't need to be told he was my number one player, but I was trying to bring him along and making sure that he wasn't going to get hurt like his freshman year and continue to build his confidence. And by the end of the year, he was playing number one and having great success. But it was great coaching John because he was so coachable. You know, as a freshman, I challenged him to become a little bit more of a serve and volleyer, or being just only for the sake of being able to use that to his advantage. He was not a serve and volleyer at all. And, you know, very similar ways to Michael Pernfors as well as Matthias Booker. You know, great players are very, very receptive, very coachable, and they are able to see the long road. You know, they're not looking at short-term success as much as how to get, you know, to where they want to go. And John was very understanding that, you know, he needed to develop a transition game. He was big and not the fastest guy around. So, you know, playing from the baseline forever, you know, wasn't going to be strictly, you know, something he wanted to do. So he was, you know, he had a very natural forehand. His forehand was an outstanding shot as well. And people, you know, always focused on his serve because it was exceptional and probably one of the best shots in the history of the sport. But his forehand was tremendous. And so the thing with John is, you know, how to use his backhand, how to stay neutral with his backhand and how to take control of the point, either with a big serve and a big forehand or, you know, occasionally serve and volley. So, you know, he became extremely good. I really thought when he turned pro, I thought his success was more going to be leaning towards his doubles because he was such a good doubles player. But he made up his mind to make a mark and give it the best shot that he could in singles. And, you know, he was so ready. You know, in his first summer, he reached the finals. He won his first future. Then he went to a challenger. He got a wild card from the USTA, won the challenger, and got a wild card in Washington, D.C., at the ATP Tour event there, and he won
four or five straight matches, 7-6 in the third. and that was the beginning of tiebreaker John. And he lost to Andy Roddick in the finals in three sets. You know, and he was off to the races, you know, was able to get into the third or fourth round at the U.S. Open and played Roger Federer center court when Roger was at his best, and won the first set in Ash in front of 24,000 fans. So, you know, playing in college tennis and playing on our venue in front of 5,000-6,000 people here for the NCAAs, you know, had him ready for the big stage. So it was fun to see. And, you know, he's always represented not only University of Georgia, he's represented his family first class manner, the University of Georgia, the U.S. in Davis Cup. Some of his best performances were in Davis Cup, you know, beat maybe Federer. He may have, you know, beaten, I forgot where he clinched, Eastern Europe somewhere. Anyway, he was an outstanding Davis Cup player because he just loved playing for a team so much. And that was, it's just been great to track his career and now to see him retire and have a wonderful family, young family. Just he's going to be a tremendous success at whatever he puts his mind to.
Yeah. Well, Coach, real quick before we move on from him, tell it. You mentioned he increased his flexibility. Any ideas on how he did that other than just stretching a lot?
This working with our trainers, with our medical staff, with our, you know, strength and conditioning coaches. He just made it. He knew that was going to be important. And, you know, from the get-go, he always traveled. He always had a team that included a physio and a chiropractor and somebody that really worked on his body, because, you know, he's such a large athlete. He made it a priority, and that was always sort of after that first year, he really came to understand that he had to take care of his body. And, you know, he played through a lot, had some issues with his ankle, had some issues with his knees. You know, he's on top of his game in that regard.
Yeah. Yeah. And to have such a long career at that size, I mean, Riley Opelka struggles with it, you know, so yeah. I mean, you can sort of see that you've got to put a lot of work and dedication into it, and it's just got to be part of the routine and part of the discipline. So it's that says a lot for him. You know, here in Louisville, we have a player that you may have missed on, Eric Quigley. He works with my son a little bit, and when was making his decision, I know it's down to Kentucky and Georgia. Can you talk a little bit about, you know, recruiting Eric and what that would have meant for the team?
No, Eric turned out to be a great one. You know, he really played a big part in bringing Kentucky up to an elite status. And, you know, it was just always a very tough opponent for us, both singles and doubles. And just a great young man. And, you know, I didn't know he was coaching or teaching tennis in Louisville. But, yeah, he was always a very good player for them for 4 years.
Yeah, he does a little bit on the side. He works. He has a regular job, and then he does a little bit of work with some of the juniors here. But he's, like you say, he's just a great, great guy. Just super. You know, he loves the game so much, and he loves teaching it the right way. So he's a great guy. But
he was a good one that got away.
Yeah, for sure.
Well, you can't have them all. So, so one of the things I often wonder, and I know there's a lot of potential coaches that listen to the podcast, and one of the things they ask often is, what are your non-tennis related duties for the University of Georgia? Do you have to teach classes? Do you have any responsibilities that are not tennis in your job?
I don't. Tennis is a full-time job. I don't have more than 70 or 80 hours. So no, I'm just a head tennis coach, and that occupies my time.
What I might have meant by that question is also is, you obviously you coach on court, but what are the things that you do sort of off court in terms of community development, you know, building relationships, fundraising, things that we might not see in the background that you do to make the program so successful?
You know, many. I think you hit on some. You know, that you have to really connect with the community. I think that's one of the things that, you know, in order for a program to be successful, you have to be valued within your community. community in order to, for you to be able to fill the stands. You have to, mm-hmm. you know, you have to give more than you are willing to receive in that sense. You know, we have to be visible. We have to not only, you know, we have our team just, you know, visit hospitals and sick children and doing that type of stuff, but just, you know, just connecting with the local country clubs, connecting with our tennis facilities here local. We have, you know, Oconee, Clark, Athens, Clark, Oconee County tennis community. You know, through social media, we stay very connected with them. We try to promote our matches. You know, you definitely need to fundraise some. And while I don't claim to be the best or busiest at that, we have a large contingent of just a long list of former players, and they stay very close. One of the things I'm most proud of is just being able to claim to have unofficially probably the largest WhatsApp group of tennis, former tennis legends at the University of Georgia. We have over 125 former Letterman players, former players here at the University of Georgia that we kind of, it's a brotherhood, and we stay in touch, and every day is somebody's birthday, and the stories that come out each and every day, you know, are numerous, and just as a way for our former players, we have, you know, we have players from the 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s, 90s, 2000s, through the 2020, through last year, that all as they graduate, you know, they all come on and they are a part of this brotherhood. And it's probably one of the most popular things that I've done, you know, here within our program is just finding a way to keep all of our former players engaged connected. That's a lot of fun too.
And now you have some of those former players, their kids are on the team now. So talk a little bit about the culture and how, what that means as far as, you know, how you're able to build and sustain that family when now you've got, you know, Parker Jacks, whose dad played for you. You have Parker Marianchuk, whose dad played for you. Davis Taylor, his mom played on the women's team.
Yes.
But you have three sort of legacies there and they're all good players. But what's it mean to have those, that next generation?
Well, I think that for, you know, forever, you know, we have, you know, made our program about family. You know, once you're a dog, you're always a dog. And that has been a very important part of what we have built here. You know, you just don't come through the University of Georgia. You know, you're a part of it, you know, whether you played here 1 or 2 years or whether you stayed all four. You know, we just take a great deal of pride in just as coaches, you know, just playing, just, you know, being a drop in the bucket, just, you know, just affecting who these young men that come through our program become. It's important to recruit character, but it's also important for us to help develop it. And I think that, you know, for most of the kids that have come through, you know, the thing that I'm most proud of is when, you know, they all come back and say, you know, you were like my second father. You were my dad away from home, you know, kid from Romania or a kid from Serbia or a kid from France. Just being there for people and showing them you care, you know, in their development, not only as a tennis player, that's so limited, but who they become. And that takes, you know, a lot of work. You have to figure out how to reach each individual on your program and your team. It's not always the easiest to figure that one out. You know, you can't coach everybody the same way. You have to figure out how to connect with each one at their level. You know, I always refer to, you have to meet people where they are. And, you know, that's not always about where I am. And I don't, you know, I said this on a recent podcast as well. I don't coach everybody the same, and everybody's got strengths and weaknesses. And it's about, you know, strengthening your strengths, but it's also about strengthening, you know, your weaknesses and being able to you know, you have a shield and you have a sword. We always talk about that. And but on a personal level, my job is such, so much more than just being a tennis coach. Getting to know your team, each person, and knowing, you know, what's important to them, where they come from, what is their situation, is one of the most important things in order to be able to affect their lives.
Well, speaking of legacies, let me show you a video real quick. Let me see if I can get it to pop up. Can you see that?
Yeah.
Who is this 14-year-old?
Is that Davis Taylor?
That's Davis when he was 14. So I asked his mom, I said, Mariano, tell us a question you want to ask Coach. And she had two good ones. You know, Mariana's a huge tennis fan and a good fan of the podcast. And okay, good friend, fan of the podcast. And so she wants to know, what do you think makes up a really good coach? And then second, she wants to make sure that you're going to be there through Davis's full career. So she's confident multiple NCAA championships will be won, but she wonders what does the end of the career look like, and how long do you think you'll stay around?
I don't know. I've had a long career. I don't think anybody would have to guess that I'm not at the first half of my career, but. For the past 3, 4, 5 years, and I signed a 5-year contract or a 4-year contract about a year or so ago. So, I'm just having fun, and, I continue to try to make a difference in these players' lives. And, I'm just taking it as it comes. So my goal right now, I'm fully focused on the group that we have this year, and we have a very young team. We went from probably having on paper one of the better teams in the country. I think that's no secret. Ethan Quinn realized his goal of winning the NCAA singles and having an opportunity to jump into the pros probably earlier than we thought he might. We lost him after 1 year, and then Alex Mickelson, we signed him, and he all of a sudden goes to number 94 in the world. He turns pro. Ignacio Busa, number 9 in the world ITF rankings, and he had some visa issues. He was nobody I think knows about this in all specifics, but he applied for a green card 3 years ago, was waiting on a final interview, and while he's waiting for his final interview, which got frozen during COVID, he was not eligible for a student visa. So we could not get him in school. That was a first. We had never encountered anything similar to that. Yeah. So, all of a sudden you say, well, those probably on paper may be our top 3 players, some of the best 3 players in the country this year. But they're no longer here. So we have a very young team, and our focus now is to develop those guys and make them, the foundation, for years to come. And so I don't know that I can answer your question, Robert, but, we're here and we're developing players just like we have for the last 42 years. And, that's still a lot of fun.
Hey, Robert, what was the first question that Mariana had?
Y'all hear me?
Yeah.
Yeah.
My internet went out. Sorry about that. Yeah. The first question was, can you just describe what you think the primary characteristics of a great coach are?
I think I may have touched a little bit on that. I think it's just, being able to connect with different players, who have different needs, different goals, different games, strengths and weaknesses. I think that's the key. I've seen a lot of great coaches that just haven't been able to understand that. And they have in many ways defined that this is the way the game should be played and the way the game should be coached. And they don't provide for enough flexibility. I always, you know, have a very, I tell my coaches, Jamie Hunt and Bryce, and, you know, you always have to have, you know, a game plan for every practice, you know, but it's got to be written in sand. I mean, you know, you have one or two kids that all of a sudden look a little out of sorts. They, you know, you may have a kid that stayed up till 2 o'clock in the morning taking, you know, studying for a test. You know, you have another kid that his girlfriend, you know, canned him. You know, you have to deal with young men and young women if you're a women's coach, and you know, you have to be able to understand. You know, all I ask is that they are upfront with me. And if you had a project due and you didn't get your sleep and you're a little bit at less than 100%, I know about it. Number one, and number two, that you give me the best that you've got. You know, for me, it's my biggest thing is I try to, you know, utilize every minute of practice. You know, I'd rather have a good 2.5 hour practice than a half speed 3.5 hour practice.
We
practice fast, we practice with purpose, we practice with a lot of energy. All of those things are paramount. And I think the other thing is, you know, coaches cannot demand more than they are willing to give. You know, if you're wanting your team to be defined, you know, by being fully engaged and full of energy and energetic and you know, fight, you have to be that. They're going to see through you if they don't see those characteristics. You know, if you want them to be engaged, you have to be engaged every minute of practice. So all of those things kind of add up and are important not only to our program, but you know, I think in order to be successful, you know, that those are things that you've got to possess.
And it's, I would say it's very impressive that you've been able to do this and sustain that level for this long. A lot of coaches, they burn out after 20 years in a job, and you sort of see some of these programs start to falter and sort of fade. George's has continued to stay at the highest level. And like I say, it's for you to do this for 36 years, you know, 42, including your assistant time, beyond impressive and something that everybody should aspire to. One of the things that's also interesting is that your son is also doing a great job coaching right now. He's maybe doing too good of a job with Mickelson. But can you talk a little bit about maybe what advice you gave him when he decided that he was going to go, decided to coach junior tennis and find some local talent in Southern California? I know he's working with Lerner Tien too. So two of the very top.
It wasn't until Eric's senior year in college that he at dinner, he came to dinner, he came to the house for dinner and divulged that he wanted to, he was going to be a tennis coach. And I went, why would you want to do that? he said, yeah, I don't want to be locked in an office. This is what I want to do. I think I want to give this a shot. I thought he was crazy, but he has done an exceptional job. He's a terrific young man. And he became an assistant coach at Boise State under Greg Patton for 1 year, and then went to Newport to visit a friend and spend the summer. And, you know, the guy said, you know, if you come down here, you can make some money during the summer teaching lessons. And I thought, oh, wonderful. Great. You know, I have a summer camp here on campus. So, you know, you can make some extra money. And then towards the end of the summer, he said, I think I want to stay here and do this. And I go like, what? He said, no, I want to develop a business. And I think that the most impressive thing that, you know, Eric has done is not only coaching and becoming a great coach, but just seeing the business side of it. And he's had several partners. Jay Levitt is partner in Tier One Academy now, Tier One Performance it's called, and he's an incredible coach as well. He's had several partners before that moved on and to do other things, and he just stayed focused, and they have a tremendous, probably probably one of the most successful, if not the most successful, tennis development program in Southern California right now, with Lerner winning back-to-back Kalamazoos, yeah. Alex Mickelson just coming out of nowhere. I saw the potential, right. You know, a long time ago. But, you know, Eric and Jay have done a tremendous job developing that that academy, and just deserve everything they get, you know, accolades their way.
Well, we definitely need to get him on the podcast. So maybe we could talk to you about getting your son on here.
I'm sure you'll have no problem.
Is he heading off to Australia with those guys soon?
Yes, he's set to visit us. His mom hasn't seen him in a whole year. I saw him at Kalamazoo. I saw him at the Open. You know, I see him from time to time on the road, but his mom is desperate to see him. He's coming home for a few days and basically has to go back the 25th on Christmas Day back to California, because they leave on the 26th to go to Australia, him and Alex.
That's awesome. One of the things you talked about earlier was, you know, sort of the community engagement and how you get crowds there. But, you know, one of the things that's amazing to hear when, you know, you go to, say, a local college tennis match at most colleges, and you're in the 100 to 200 range of spectators, and you guys have over 2,000. How do you make that up in Athens? Is it local community? Is it college students, kids from Atlanta coming up? Could you sort of talk about the mix of those that attendance, where it comes from, and how do you get them there?
It's mostly a combination of our community and community engagement and engaging our student body. While we also have a lot of people that come from out of town, you know, academies and clubs from Atlanta bringing their juniors, you know, different academies. And Atlanta has a lot of tennis players, as you well know, but just engaging and creating an atmosphere where people feel welcome, you know. And throughout the years, we've held clinics for little kids, you know, and we have a second stadium up on the hill here. So we've had clinics during our matches. We've had Easter egg hunts during Easter, you know, Sunday, during a match, just being creative, pulling people in. And, you know, once you create a sense of energy and a sense of engagement and a sense of excitement, I think, you know, a lot of what these players want is that atmosphere that's unique to Athens, right? And you can't have that just passively playing, you know, without much emotion. So what you give as a player, energy wise, you get back twofold, tenfold sometimes, right? I think people want to be a part of that atmosphere. And I think in Athens, we have gotten to the point where we've created that for the fans. And so it's not hard to keep people coming back once they come. You know, I've had so many people that I encountered go like, you know, I've never been to a college tennis match, and only a couple, you know, tennis matches in my life. But when I come to the University of Georgia, you know, today, I'd never thought this, I never knew this was so exciting, you know. And it's, you know, I relate, like, you go to the U.S. Open, you don't go to the U.S. Open and just see one court, you know, for the most of us, unless you go at night and ash is the only thing going. You know, you come, you go to the U.S. Open and, you know, you watch a little bit here and you know, watch on an outside court, and then you go to the grandstand and you see for a set, or and you move around, you want to watch a little bit of doubles. You watch the women, you watch the men, you watch mixed doubles, you watch, you know, different players. And sometimes a match can get boring. But the beautiful thing about college tennis is, you know, you know, if a match gets boring, you just look one or two courts down from you, and there's something you can gravitate to. You may relate to a single. I know my wife relates to one or two players and connects with their energy a lot more than others, for whatever reason. And I think that's the beauty of college tennis. And we need to find a way to promote that and to, you know, continue to get people to come out and just try to grow the sport that way.
Yeah. Coach, I'm curious, you know, it surprises me that in a lot of colleges that the matches are, the fan is not the focus. And what I mean by that is they might do a Friday match at 10 a.m. Why do you think some universities focus on orienting the match around fan engagement and participation and viewership? Because you're right. When we went to the national championship, we've been to regular season matches. The environment in Athens is just fantastic. And it does exactly what you said. It makes you want to come back and be part of that again. Why do you think some schools just don't focus on it? Play their match on Friday at 10 a.m. and get on the road so they can play their Sunday match.
Okay. That just sounds like they're focusing more on convenience, on personal convenience. I don't know. I can't tell you that. You know, in the Southeastern Conference, you know, a long time ago, we just decided that, you know, we should try to play matches at night. That's at 5 o'clock or 6 o'clock. So on Fridays, you know, you can schedule as late as 6 or 7 p.m. I think it is. You know, you play sometimes Friday, Sunday. On Sundays, we get it. We have to get back to go to class on Monday. You know, sometimes the last flight out is at 5 o'clock, 6 o'clock. We have to, you know, we have to account for that. So most of our Sunday matches are 1 o'clock after people get out of church or lunch or whatever.
Which makes total sense. Yep.
And try to promote it that way. But, you know, I don't recall last match I played at 10 o'clock other than maybe, you know, in an SEC championship where you only have six courts and you have four matches back to back. But, you know, you just have to, you have to think, you know, look, we're not very valuable to our athletic director if we have five people in the grandstand. They're not gonna put money into your facility until you can prove that you're working hard enough to make the sport relevant. So I challenge coaches to try to, you know, reach out, connect with the local tennis pros, local tennis clubs. Community, engagement is huge. Student engagement. I had for 40 years, 30 something years, our tennis team go out and talk to fraternities and sororities and try to get them out. I even contemplated putting a jacuzzi on top of the grandstand. And, you know, the fraternity that brings out the most people, they can use the jacuzzi. That didn't go too well.
That's what I'm talking about. That would have been fun. It would have been popular, Coach. That would have been popular. Insurance probably wouldn't have liked it, but the fraternities would have loved it.
That didn't go too well. But, finding ways to connect and make it fun. You know, if you're shushing fans, if you're shushing fans in the grandstand because they're talking, you know, they're not coming back. If you got your referee going over there and say, you got to be quiet, you ladies can't be talking that loud, you know, you got to move away. People are not going to feel welcome. People are going to go where they're, you know, having fun and are able to participate. I think, while it's important, make sure that our fans are being, showing good sportsmanship and not being, you know, insulting and saying things that shouldn't be said. Other than that, I believe that if you're not trying to distract or yell in the middle of a second serve, I think, fans should be encouraged to just be there and have fun.
I agree. 100%.
I think that's that was some wisdom for our younger coaches in college that was really important. And a lot of them want to come to Georgia and be the coach because of the atmosphere. What I think some of them don't realize is they can be part of creating that atmosphere wherever they are. So I love the answer. And I think also realizing that being relevant to the athletic director, a part of that helps you with your facilities. And that happens when you have a crowd there, right?
Yeah.
So the coach really is a part of all of that. It doesn't just happen by accident. So appreciate that answer, Coach. Go ahead, Scott.
Yeah. And Mitch, speaking of your facility, I know you guys have a new indoor facility coming in and some improvements. When will that indoor facility be available? And I assume it'll be ready for by 2026. When you guys host,
it's supposed to be ready February 6th. So a month and a half.
Awesome.
I get to look at it. I get to look at it and go like, that's coming along or that's going a little slow. What's going on? They've already poured the asphalt for the tennis courts inside. Okay. So right now they're working inside and just all of the little things that usually take the longest. I'm hoping that the facility will be ready on time. Because we're scheduled to play Georgia Tech on February 6th, the first day that they're supposed to be open. So, you know, they're running tight. You know how everything goes.
Yeah.
You know, it's a $28.5 million facility. You know, it's just phenomenal. It completes, you know, our facility in many ways. You know, we have our new grandstand rebuilt. We have a completely new grandstand for 3 years old now. You know, just the press box, new press box, elevators, you know, ADA. You know, our old stadium wasn't ADA. I mean, we built it in 1980 and didn't have an elevator for the press box. And now we have a stringing room and bathrooms and you know, all kinds of things down underneath the grandstands. And, you know, along with our indoor facility, we have a complete, you know, we have completed, I think, for now and for a good long time, you know, improvements in our facility. And we're looking forward to hosting the NCAA championships in 2026.
Well, we're looking forward to being there as well. But I want to talk real quick about recruiting and sort of your approach to it. And how you identify recruits. And, you know, sort of talk about how important it is for you to have a balance maybe between international and U.S. players, and just open up to that.
Well, yeah, I mean, I believe that the University of Georgia is a state university. And so we try to get the best player from the state if he can help us. We believe that with our tradition of developing players and the atmosphere that we have here and the experience that kids have when they play at the University of Georgia and the tradition that we've built, we're successful in recruiting, you know, regionally because of that. So, you know, we try to look at the best players in the South and best players in the state, best players in the South. And again, you can't have success anymore just being a completely American team. You know, it's hard. You know, if in 2001 we won the NCAA championships with the team of all Americans, but that's hard to do. It's becoming harder and harder. This is so much talent, and we're able now to recruit all across the globe, and people in Eastern Europe and in South America, all over Europe are now discovering that they can. You know, come through college in order to accomplish being a successful professional. So more and more tennis players are discovering, you know, college tennis as a viable option to develop. So we have more players. We have a bigger base to recruit from. So, you know, for us, you know, with exceptions, I guess, I'm not sure that many, but you know, we always have one or two, sometimes three players that are international, but we've been able to continue to recruit some of the top American talent, and we always enjoy that. But I think it adds to our program when we have one or two players or three players from different parts of the world. They bring different perspective. Our American kids are enriched by them and what they have to offer. And so I am not opposed to it. And, you know, but at the same time, I believe that we all should try to do our part to develop American tennis, especially if, you know, we're an American institution, and especially if you're, you know, a state institution, you know, so that's the way I think when I'm recruiting.
Yeah. And
that balanced approach, I think a lot of people would agree with you. Go ahead.
Yeah, Scott. 100%. I just say, I think what you hit on with how the international players add culture to the program. And it also gives these players that now they want to travel, they want to see things. So I think it really enriches the American experience to play with a kid from Romania or Chile or wherever. And
yeah, we've had some of our American kids, you know, like Philip Henning from South Africa. I mean, like Blake Kreuter traveled to South Africa, and you know, that was a cultural. I mean, like that's a better education than you have in half your classes. You know, and just living the life and meeting people and traveling internationally and you know, so, and he's not the only case. I think that you know, some of these relationships evolve from these kids that that come from different parts of the world, and their lives are all enriched.
And I noticed that you guys have also embraced the transfer portal, bringing in players like Hammer Stewart a couple of years ago, last year Teodor Juska. And I don't think anybody loves Georgia more than Teodor Juska, and he was only there for 1 year.
So, yeah, I mean, we've had 3 years, the previous 3 years, where we were very lucky and we benefited from not the transfer portal per se, but graduate transfer. So, you know, Billy Rowe came from Vanderbilt, and he did a master's in 1 year. All three of these guys, Tristan McCormick the following year, along with Hamish Stewart, you know, Hamish got his master's in 1 year. And this past year, you know, Teodor Juska. And yeah, I don't know anybody that did more promoting on social media. Not even our promotions department could match Teodor.
Robert, you may not know this, Robert, but he started the podcast about Georgia tennis. So, I mean,
he
was into it.
He spoke at just about every sorority and fraternity, and he went to Carson Beck. Who's our quarterback? Stetson Bennett last year. He got Stetson Bennett to tweet to about a million of his followers that we had a match against Kentucky the next day, and the place was, you know, filled to the brim. And we, you know, he played a huge part in creating that atmosphere for us and getting fans.
That's awesome, coach. That's really cool. Do you know a guy in the communications department named Trey Littlefield?
Sure. He's our longtime sports information department liaison. I've known Trey for
us. Yeah, so in Northeast Mississippi, where I'm at near Oxford, he's from there, and I've known him since he was probably 14.
Oh my God.
Good guy. Really good guy.
I'm going to have to tell him to tune in and watch this podcast because he just became famous.
I think he follows us on Twitter, so he can retweet it for us and we'll retweet for him. But he's a good guy. He's a small town Northeast Mississippi guy. Yeah.
He's the best.
So I'd imagine if you took a poll of every player that was, say, a graduate transfer, but they couldn't go back to their old school, I bet 90% would say they want to play their last season at Georgia. I think, you know, I just think that that's the crowds, the atmosphere, the competition, the schedule, it's everything a player wants. So I think you've built it. And, you know, like you say, just by having the quality players that keep transferring in shows that people that maybe they didn't know college tennis, when they see what college tennis should be, they end up in Athens.
And it's not so much, and it's a source of pride, really. Players that played somewhere else, that basically after they graduate and you run into them, they basically, man, we had some rough matches over there. It was tough to win at Georgia, you guys. But you know what? Even though it was hard and it was tough, that was my best memory of playing college tennis, was playing you guys there. And sometimes they beat us, right? Beating you guys over there in front of your fans. That was the best highlight of my career, you know, the highlight of my career. By the same token, you know, a lot of kids that we wound up losing to other programs, when they tell me that, I just, you know, to myself, I told you should have come here.
That's right.
Hey, well, Scott, you want to jump in the fast feed?
Yeah. If you have a few minutes, we can just jump into the fast feed here, if you don't mind.
What's that?
Yeah. Fast questions, quick answers.
Oh, Lord.
Okay. So we'll start with when you guys are on the road, what's your go-to restaurant before a match?
You know, the guys love places like Cava and some of these Bolle, and they're healthy, but they're pretty fast. But I insist a lot of times on doing more sit downs. I honestly believe that, and this is not a short answer, but I believe that, you know, our team really grows together at dinner.
Yeah.
You know, just putting their phones aside and just talking and spending time together. That's quality time, I think, for our team. But Chipotle, they love Chipotle.
That's right. So.
Every coach says that.
Yes.
Every player says that, yeah. Is that a rule, though, when you have a team dinner that the phones are down?
Yeah, well, I mean, yeah, a lot of sometimes we put them, everybody puts their phone in the middle of the table and we don't touch them. But it's gotten to the point where we don't really have to say it much, and, yeah, and they understand. I'll say, going back to food, they won't argue when I take them to Fogo de Chao and spend over $1,200. They love that.
Nice place. Yeah, nice place. Yeah. Yeah. Well, tell us about something about college tennis that you would change.
That I would change. Oh, I don't know. It's a tough one. I've seen the evolution in so many ways, whether it is Doosad or no ad, let or no let. You know, I don't know how much time we're saving with no ad now, after being probably one of the biggest proponents of no ad. I just don't know that we're saving a whole lot of time. I could go back and say some of my best memories are when we used to play two out of three sets in doubles, and doubles was after singles. And when the match was tied 3-3, to have two out of three sets in doubles, man, that was a marathon. But some of the most exciting finishes were a long time ago when we did that. But I'm not saying that. Fun. Let's go back to that. But I don't know that I would change a whole lot, other than just, yeah, I would love to see, tennis, college tennis on TV. And I would like to see Tennis Channel come to the realization that they have a responsibility a little bit, too. In the development and how we grow the game. If you're calling yourself a tennis channel, there's responsibility that goes along with that.
And that would include not showing pickleball, right?
That's true. I mean, look at the look at the Golf Channel. They got college golf all throughout, hours upon hours, and they're benefiting, our college golf game.
Yeah, and I think
not just that.
Yeah, with 16 players from college tennis in the Australian Open main draw, you're seeing the next generation. So it makes sense. I mean, these are the players, Ben Shelton. These are the players you're going to be watching in two or three more years down the road.
That's right. So,
all right,
and that's a conversation that we have a lot, and it's we totally agree. So go ahead, Scott.
Yeah. Best book about tennis and non-tennis book.
Ooh, I have several. I have a collection of books that are not about tennis. Magic of Thinking Big, Napoleon Hill, I love as well. Master Key to Riches. Just all books that were instrumental in changing how I thought as a tennis player, my thinking as a tennis player. I don't read a whole lot of tennis books, to be honest with you.
Okay.
Personal development books, are more my take.
Gotcha.
Yeah, good stuff. Good stuff. So, tell us who your favorite ATP player right now to watch is.
I would have to say Alcaraz. It's mind blowing what he does. I mean, the explosiveness, the speed, the creativity. He's revolutionizing our sport. I mean, it makes me wonder how long can he stay healthy? How do we go from the athleticism is incredible. I'm so excited about this year seeing now, because I've always said Sinner hasn't gotten physically to where Alcaraz is yet, but he seems to be getting there. That's going to be the next, I think, big, rivalry, Roger, Rafa. Yeah. And then, Djokovic. But I think that's going to be something that we're going to enjoy for years to come.
Yeah, Sinner and Alcaraz, whenever they play, it's must-watch TV. They just bring out the best in both of each other, and it's just amazing tennis to watch, 100%. Let's see. What's the biggest waste of time on the practice court?
The biggest what?
Waste of time.
Well, biggest waste of time is wasting time. Everything that's not being productive or biggest waste of time. You know, we took our benches off the court. Nobody can sit down at practice. We take a short, sip of water. We come together for the next drill. I give instructions, not only on what we're doing, but what it's meant to accomplish, so that they know why they're doing the drill, what it's meant to accomplish. And we go just extending, talking about things that are not important, having time, idle time is the worst thing to have during practice, idle time.
Love that answer.
Yeah, I think for young coaches, the why we're doing the drill we're doing and the skill that the drill is attacking, a lot of young coaches just grab bag. Let me just pull the drill out of the bag and we'll do this drill. Why? I don't know. Just because we're doing a drill. And so I think a lot of young coaches don't realize every drill has a purpose. That's great to hear. So last question, best thing about being a Georgia Bulldog, and then we'll let you go.
Just a sense of family that, when you come through our program. I'm speaking now as a former player, not as a coach. Just the relationships, the sense of family. I share so much with players that were here prior to us even getting scholarship. We didn't get scholarships until 1968. Georgia didn't become relevant until the first time we won the SEC championship was like 2 years later. Florida had scholarships. Tulane had scholarships. Georgia Tech had scholarships. They were in the SEC, Tulane and Georgia Tech. Big mistake, they left. But anyway, Georgia became relevant in 1970, and just the things that I can talk to somebody that came through our program in the 50s, and a good bit older than myself, and some of the things that I can talk to some of my players that played in the 2010s, it's just something so many things that we share, that we have in common, experiences, what it means to be part of our program is something that I've been able to hold on to and continue to foster and develop. And I think that it is the glue that holds us together.
Yeah, it's not just a 4 or 5 year thing. It's for life is kind of what you're saying. That's pretty cool.
Yeah.
Well, Coach, thanks so much for being on. As you mentioned, you're one of the biggest names in college tennis. You've been around for a long time, and you've had such a successful career, and you've no signs of slowing down. So thrilled to have you on the show.
Good to be with you, Scott.
Thanks, Robert. Coach.
Take care.
Thanks, Coach. All right, have a Merry Christmas.
Talk to you soon.
You too. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Up my appetite, don't leave me high and dry. Oh, well, I don't wanna jinx it, baby. And treat myself and just fine. Don't wanna overthink it, baby. Just treat. Yeah.